The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, just as shoppers hit the malls on Black Friday, global stock markets were hit by Omicron, the newly named variant of concern that has led to a fresh wave of travel restrictions. Though there's still lots of information we don't know about Omicron, a wave of fear rushed over investors as the narrative has flipped decidedly into negative territory for COVID-related news. Speaking of narratives, in light of the Thanksgiving holiday, we are going to forego our normal programming schedule for this weekend show and re-air one of our FS Insider interviews from earlier this week to discuss the narrative machine, how it differs from Ray Dalio's conception of the economic machine, and why this is one of the most powerful frameworks for understanding how the markets and global economy function. We hope you enjoy this fascinating interview, and if you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday premium podcast and would like to hear more of our interviews and content throughout the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. Ben Hunt is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Second Foundation Partners and also the author of the widely read Epsilon Theory newsletter. Ben, do you mind explaining your view of how the economy and the markets work via what you call the narrative machine and how that differs from perhaps Ray Dalio's description of the economic machine?
Sure, happy to. And yeah, my professional career has been focused on narratives. So we're talking, 30 plus years going back to academic days of dissertations and teaching and the like, to starting a software company, to starting a hedge fund, to now writing about markets and doing basic research on markets. It's all been about what I like to call, what is called, unstructured data, right? So it's not the stuff you get in a spreadsheet. It's not the stuff you get on a price and earnings and volume, some sort of chart you get off of Bloomberg. It's all the things that we hear in the day, all the things that we read in the day. That's what unstructured data is. And the stories, the story arcs, the messages, the themes, everything that comes across in what we hear and what we read every day, that to me is the most fundamental aspect of what it means to be a social animal. And that to me is the most fundamental aspect of all of our social activities, the big two being politics and markets. So I've had a professional career, 30 plus years, trying to study unstructured data, trying to study narratives. And I really think that that is the most fundamental thing that drives what actually happens in the social activities of politics and markets. 5 years ago, when I first started writing about this notion of what I called the narrative machine, it was both an homage and a critique, frankly, of Ray Dalio, the Bridgewater founder and CEO, his concept of the economic machine. Now, what Dalio means by the economic machine is to think of our economy, to think of markets, just like we think about a machine, right? It has inputs and outputs. And I agree. I think there are mechanistic properties to how a political system or a market system actually works. I'm with him on that. But I also believe that these mechanistic properties, what we would call in the traditional study of macroeconomics or political science, I think that these properties, these rules, I think they are subsumed within a much more fundamental set of mechanistic properties. And that's what I call the narrative machine. Because I think in the same way that, yes, stocks and bonds and votes and everything like that respond to things that we can say, the exchange rate changes here. Here's what happens in the price of XYZ. I believe in those mechanistic properties. But I also believe that there are more important mechanistic properties. There are more important ways in which we as human beings are hardwired and socially trained to respond to narratives, to messages and the unstructured data of what we hear and what we read. I think that those are the rules that are actually more important, more basic to our social worlds. And I'll use an analogy here that I admit is a little self-flattering here, right? So I think I would say that the narrative machine is to the economic machine what Einsteinian physics is to Newtonian physics. In other words, in most circumstances, all you need is Newtonian physics to make sense of the world. I mean, in our daily lives, when you're not traveling close to the speed of light, you know, F equals MA and, you know, the basic aspects of what Newton came up with, the apple falling from the tree, that works. And that's all you need. But I also think that when reality starts to become an edge case, in physics terms, when you start going really fast or you start dealing with truly massive objects, in our cases, you know, of human worlds, social worlds, it's like global quantitative easing, central banks that dominate everything. These are edge cases. And I think that when these events happen, when reality becomes an edge case, you have to focus on the more fundamental laws of the universe, in this case, a social universe, to make sense of what's happening now and to calculate what's going to happen next. I think that looking at narrative is how we can make sense of the edge case world that we live in today. And I think it's more useful than looking at the economic machine. It includes everything that the economic machine has, but it's looking at it, I think, in a more comprehensive way with rules and laws that pertain in these circumstances that might not in, let's call it, more ordinary times.
I love what you wrote in 2016 when you first articulated this, I believe. Mm-hmm. You say, today I want to propose a new metaphor for the world as it is, a narrative machine, where macroeconomic reality is still understood as a cybernetic system, but where the translation of reality into actual human behaviors and actual investment outcomes takes place within a larger machine of strategic communication and game playing. You describe the difference between the economic machine and the narrative machine as being similar to the difference between Newtonian and Einsteinian physics, that we're now in this edge case environment. Where does government policy fit into this in terms of nudging us closer to the narrative machine and maybe further away from the economic machine?
Yeah, I'll give you two examples, one from government and one that really has very little to do with, with government. The best example I can give you for how government policy, well, there are two, right? One is monetary policy and two is fiscal policy. Let me start with monetary policy. I think we've beaten up to death, right? So the fact that it is the words of central banks, it is what they call communication policy. It is what they call forward guidance. This is what moves markets. Yes, there's a mechanistic impact from buying everything, right? Buying mortgage-backed securities, buying treasuries, buying, expanding the balance sheet, buying stuff. Yes, there's a mechanistic impact. Much more important, though, is the behavioral impact from their guidance, their words that, oh, yes, we intend to continue that, or no, we expect to taper that, or yes, we expect to accelerate that. These are the things that really move markets. Right? It's not the mechanistic impact of, oh, we bought $50 billion worth of stuff this month. What is the mechanistic impact on price? But it is the behavioral impact of the words, of the narrative. What do they intend to do? This is a very conscious decision by all central banks today to use their words, to use their communications, not to describe what they actually believe about the world, but as a tool to try to influence market behavior directly. It's monetary policy, fiscal policy the same. What does it mean to have a connection between taxes and spending? I think it used to be our basic conception of what money and government was all about, that government spent to provide services and necessary things for the population that we couldn't provide on our own, and that they would tax in order to provide that. My strong view is that connection between taxes and spending has been completely severed. That tether has been snipped. And the result being that you say, well, wait a second. If taxes aren't being used to pay for what we are spending as a people, as a government, what are taxes for? Why do we have taxes? The answer, of course, is now that taxes are becoming an instrument of equity, an instrument of justice, not an instrument of paying for something, but of a way to reward or punish. I think that's profoundly troubling and depressing, but I think that's what is. That is the edge case that we exist in today in both fiscal policy and monetary policy. But I'm going to give you one more, Chris, one more edge case in the what I think has been a really important driver of people realizing, increasingly realizing, saying, you know what, it really is just narratives all the way down. especially when it comes to money. And that driver, I think, has been the explosion in cryptocurrencies. There's no there when it comes to any coin or token, any gold or silver coin. The dollar, it's all based on stories and narratives, but that's so obvious when it comes to crypto. When an Elon tweet can create or destroy fortunes, when we've got, you know, these dog memes, Shiba Inu dog memes that are so impactful. It's so obvious that crypto is purely an exercise in narrative. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. I think I'm fascinated by crypto because I think it is tapping into this more fundamental machine that drives our social world, the narrative machine.
Yeah. You know, we spoke with another book author who talked about the interesting synchronicity that we see through history and the development of economic theory and how that relates to certain social developments. It was fascinating. But when we got to crypto towards the end of the interview, we talked about how money is converging through cryptographic protocols and through the crypto space, whether that's Bitcoin, Ethereum, or otherwise. It's converging with narrative so that each cryptocurrency is directly tied to a piece of software, or in this case, a certain application. And that application is at its root really a way of either implementing an idea, a story, right? And so there is that convergence, just like you're saying. And, you know, I want to point out that you've been articulating this now for many years, going back to at least 2016. And like you said, 30 years of examining unstructured data even before that. But you seem to have a very strong advocate for this idea. We spoke with Robert Shiller, Nobel Prize winning economist, on our podcast in 2019 about his book, Narrative Economics, which is all about, as his subtitle states, how stories go viral and drive major economic events. So I think that this idea that you've been articulating and that you've been really teaching others about is clearly the direction or the way that we do need to be thinking about how the markets operate.
Yeah, for sure, Chris. I first started writing about this in 2012. And, you know, I'd talk about these ideas of narrative to other hedge fund managers and I'll say people embedded in our world of finance. And almost the uniform response I'd get would be, oh, yeah, I guess, yeah, these kind of narratives are kind of important in the short term, maybe. But they're an aberration from what really drives markets, which are the fundamentals. It's 2012. So, you know, what we're experiencing today, this is a sustained fundamental economic recovery in the United States. And so our, you know, value stock picking, I'm sure it's going to work again really soon. And then comes 2013 and 2014 and 2015. And, you know, at this point, we've had 12 years of those fundamentals. It's not working, and it hasn't worked. And so what I found, because now everybody's a believer in narrative because it this is what has moved the world for the last 12 years. My point is, it actually moved the world before then as well. It's just that we had a narrative of fundamentals. So that every multiple you have in market is a story. That's what a multiple is. It's a story. What value, what price should you put on this cash flow or this metric of the real world? Well, you know, that it's not just the size of that multiple, but the idea that you should put a multiple on this observed characteristic, that is also a story. In the most basic sense, this is what Wall Street does. They are advertisers. They are story creators. Every theme you hear on, you know, whatever it is you read and listen to about markets, whatever idea you have is that this is worth X in terms of a multiple. These are all stories. I'm not saying they're false, right? But I'm saying that they are a story and that other stories can and do rise to replace old stories. This is what human history is all about. It really is the history, his story, right? It is all of human history can be told and can only be told through stories. This was true 2,000 years ago, it's true 1,000 years ago, it's true today. It's the water in which we swim, so it's hard to see. But that's what my research has really been about, is being trying to find ways of measuring and visualizing these narratives that we all know impact us. But once you can actually see them, once you can measure them, well, that opens up a whole new way of investing, frankly.
Yeah, and I want to get into the narrative structure and some of the ways that you do that. But before we get into that, you know, it's interesting because a lot of times you talk to people and many of us, I think we all deep down want to think that we create our view of the world from objective facts, from data, from evidence. Yeah. You know, yeah. We think that we're all scientists, right? And that's the way that we are interacting and assessing our world. And many times, you know, I'm speaking with people, this is the view that they'll espouse to me in terms of how they come to their conclusions. Well, I looked at the data and then I researched the facts and this was the conclusion that I came to. Yeah. And I am an objective thinker on this issue. And I love it because I think just being honest with ourselves, like you said, history for 2,000 years, to come back and tell people, well, I'm sorry, but you really are thinking in terms of narratives and stories. That's the basis of what drives almost all of what we do. And we like to think that it's data, it's facts, but it's stories. And we seek out that data or that evidence that confirms to those deeply held unconscious biases or stories that we bought into a long time ago.
Chris, I grew up in the religion of value investing. I still believe in it, right? I still have faith that real world companies making real world things in real world better ways with real world better managers, that the price of those, of a fractional ownership share in the cash flows of that real world company, I think the price should be higher than companies that don't do any of those things. And that's my faith. That's my religion. And it's been a long journey for me to realize it is a faith. It is a religion. I can't burn that out of my psyche, but what I can do is step back and try to, as Socrates said, know thyself. And I think that's what we're trying to do here, right? With these efforts of trying to visualize and measure narratives. The big point here is the old poker saying that if you don't know who the sucker is in the first 30 minutes of playing, it's you. The goal here is just not to be the sucker at the table. The goal here is to be able to take a critical distance, to step back and ask important questions like, well, why am I reading this now? Why am I being told, why is my attention being placed onto this thing that I'm now going to do my due diligence on, like, you know, financials or crypto coins? What is it that is pushing my attention onto this subject matter, right? That's one big way in which we are all, and God knows that includes me also, I mean, in which we are all sucked into the story-making machine of Wall Street in Washington, because it's exactly the same thing with politics. Politics is a story-making exercise, just like Wall Street is. It is an advertising effort. In the same way that if you see a lot of beer commercials while you're watching the Super Bowl, you're going to be thinking about beer. And that's exactly the same process that happens in politics and markets with, again, the unstructured data that we swim in, the ocean that we swim in on a daily basis. With the advent of social media, the delivery mechanism for these messages for unstructured data has just become that much more efficient and effective. I'll tell you, that's why when we apply our models of visualizing and measuring narrative, really, unlike every bank factor you can imagine, our signals are getting stronger over time, not weaker over time. This is the secular trend, the secular world we live in today, where narrative and the communication of stories is becoming even more important and even more impactful in our social lives.
How does the debate or discussion over inflation fit into this? Because this is something that's obviously just pervasive on financial news channels. I mean, we've been talking about it on a podcast for years now. where does this fit into the narrative machine?
Well, I'll discuss two aspects of this, one political and one more market-oriented. I'll start with the political. What we talk about in our research and our writing is a concept we call auto-tuning. So you know what auto-tuning is, right? It's when, you know, somebody goes into the studio to sing a song, lay down a, you know, vocal track, you use the the machine to tune that singer's voice. They can be all over the place. They can sound terrible, but through the sound mixing, through the auto tuner, you can make it sound on key and on tune. Now, effectively, there is no sound recording of the human voice in song you can hear that's not being auto tuned. This is a political process as well. So when there is a narrative that a story like inflation that comes up from wherever it comes up, in this case, out of market world, political world tries to auto-tune that into the message that will be most effective in advertising to their supporters and antagonizing the other side. So what we're seeing today is that inflation in political terms is being auto-tuned into a red versus blue dimension, into a Democrat versus GOP dimension, where on the GOP side, it's now Biden inflation, right? It's becoming a advertising slogan and campaign for the midterm elections coming up. And so, of course, on the other side, on the Democratic side, we're getting these messages like, there is no inflation. It doesn't, you know, it's a figment of your imagination, right? It doesn't, it's not real. And we see that with every issue that comes up in our, again, our social worlds. On the political side, it becomes auto-tuned. It becomes associated with either the red-blue or the red-blue dimension, the Dems or the GOP. That's incredibly frustrating to me. Why? Because look, I don't think that inflation is transitory. I think that it is well embedded now in inflation expectations in the U.S. real economy, particularly around autos and housing, which still drive the U.S. real economy, also embedded in stocks, which is increasingly the asset, right? It's always been cars and houses in the real economy of the United States. Now it's stocks, or rather stonks. That's what it is. Inflation expectations are well embedded there. And yet, when I make this argument, I now am slammed into a box with people on the deep blue side, I'm sorry, the deep red side, the MAGA side, who are using inflation now as a political argument, a political weapon. I don't want to be associated with that. And yet, anything I say now about inflation to say, yeah, this is really happening, I get auto-tuned by the people who are opposed to that, right, on the blue side of the coin, to say, oh, you must be an enemy. You're a political enemy. So that's the political dimension of what's happening with inflation. It is being auto-tuned into this red versus blue dimension, and that's incredibly frustrating. On market side, what we're seeing, of course, is that the Fed, all central banks, want to say that inflation is, use the word, transitory. It's not going to be a problem. Don't worry about it. It's just year-over-year effects, et cetera. Why do they want to do this? Because they don't want to fight inflation. Fighting inflation is terrible for financial assets. It's, you know, we saw it in Q4 of 2018 when they tried to do a little bit of tightening and a little bit of tapering. Oh my God, you thought the world was coming to an end in market world. They say we have the tools to fight inflation if it becomes a problem. Yes, they do. The tools, though, create the circumstances of their own demise, though, because the tools to use them to cut off the spigot of massive liquidity that sloshes through the world, to start moving off of a zero interest rate policy, which allows the excess in terms of stories and multiples of stories That's what they don't want to do. And yet that's what they'll be forced to do if, in fact, as I believe has happened, inflation becomes embedded in the real economy.
So there's a lot of management of perceptions here from the Fed side, from the government side, fiscal or monetary side. And of course, this fits right into the narrative structure of the market. We spoke with William Poole on our podcast years back. You know, he's the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and he admitted that the Fed's role as dealer of last resort is to really restore and shape confidence. I mean, if you think about it, the consumer is the majority of what drives the economy, and if the consumer suddenly feels like, hey, I need to pull back on my spending, that's a self-fulfilling, it can lead to a self-fulfilling process of a recession. Whereas if you can help the consumer believe, hey, you should be confident, we're going to be there at your back, well, then they'll keep spending, right? So there's a huge narrative, there's a psychological component here. And I thought it was interesting that a former Fed president admitting that, just in terms of managing perceptions, managing confidence. So all of this plays, again, back into the model that you've just been describing through the narrative machine. Can you tell us a bit about the science here when it comes to the structure of the narrative machine? That is, how do you take this metaphor model and put it into practice?
Yeah, so it's actually a very old technology, and it's something, or the all the algorithms we use have been around for decades. And what they are is a brute force comparison of words. It is getting all of that unstructured data, the articles we read, the things we hear, transcripts of those, right? All of this unstructured data, and then finding the connections, the linguistic similarities between articles. And then once you note what the linguistic similarities are, you see the patterns, you see the clustering of the words and the phrases that are being used here. It's not a new idea, but what has transformed it, or the application of these old ideas just over the last 3 or 4 years, is first big data, right? Having a pipeline through Dow Jones or Thomson Reuters or one of these big information services, you just have all of that available instantaneously from all over the world. It's amazing. Even more important, though, is what I'll call big compute, the ability to tap into Amazon AWS, the ability to tap into Microsoft Azure or Google Cloud Service, and get unlimited computing processing power to compare these linguistic patterns. That's what really has revolutionized the research side of this, because it's not AI in the sense of, oh, there's some big brain that reads and translates everything. It really is this brute force approach to comparing all the words. That's what we can do. We can look at all the words today and see the patterns. And then we have our models of how these patterns impact the way we as humans are hardwired and socially trained to respond to those patterns, in exactly the same way we respond to beer commercials on a Super Bowl. We all think we are immune to this stuff, and of course, none of us are. We as social animals can no more resist the bombardment of messages and stories than an ant can resist the pheromones that its queen puts out there. It's just ours are done in words and text and not chemical pheromones. So that's at the core of what we do. And we think we've had a couple of really interesting breakthroughs now. Both, first we were just looking at the structure of these patterns. And that to us is so much more important than sentiment. Usually what people think about when they think about measuring narrative is they think about sentiment. And frankly, whether somebody is using nice words or mean words to talk about something really doesn't mean that much. What really is impactful is the way it drives your attention onto a certain subject, so that you hear a theme on CNBC, say, oh, they're all talking about the financial sector, making that up. Oh, it's a steepening yield curve and blah, blah, blah. You really ought to be looking at financials. And you may not agree with anything they say about the particular financial stock that they're hawking, but it's going to get you thinking about it. It's going to get you started on doing your due diligence. And I promise you this, if you start looking at something closely enough, you'll find something to buy. This is the way, again, we are hardwired. If you put your attention and your time into something, you will find something to buy. This is markets writ large, and this is what Wall Street does. They focus our attention on things so we can find something to buy. We've started to now measure the different stories, what we call the story archetypes, the scripts that are used over and over again. Give you a good example, right? Law and Order, the TV show, they filmed something like, I don't know, it's like 650 episodes. There are only like a dozen scripts. All 650 episodes are derived from about a dozen scripts. They're all three-act plays. You change some of the characters around, but you choose from one of the basic dozen archetypes of stories, and you create a specific episode around that. It's exactly the same in markets. That's what we do. We try to identify the same stories, or which of these stories is coming up over and over again, and how is that going to impact, in a very hardwired and socially trained manner, our behavior as investors.
So, Ben, what is your source of data in this case? Is it articles primarily, or what are you using?
It's primarily articles. But what we mean by an article is almost, or is frequently, a summation of something that's been televised. For example, you know, we'll look at the CNBC website and all their articles. You know, more than half of them are some segment that was on the show, and here's the write-up of that segment. So what we think we are capturing is the messages that we as investors are immersed in. We also capture how frequently these origin messages from Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Bloomberg, Financial Times, we also track how much these are now forwarded onto social media. So we're looking at the missionary activity, the creators of a message, and then we're looking at how that propagates throughout the entire system. It's very similar. The methodology that Bob Shiller has is right. I mean, these things literally spread like a virus. It is an epidemiological methodology that you use here to see how these things spread. And that's why when you start looking at these stories, like I have for decades now, I really see them as living organisms. I do. They are organisms that are born, they live, they grow, they reproduce, and eventually they die. When you start thinking about narrative world in those sort of terms of organisms that are fighting it out for our brain and our attention, it's hard to unsee the world once you start looking at it in that way.
Yeah, like you said, you know, the meme mania or the meme stocks, you know, that's taken from Richard Dawkins, right?
That's right.
The idea that, you know, these are specific units or organisms, in a sense, using the metaphor of an organism that's fighting for survival, right? Just like genes within viruses are fighting and replicating for survival. So there is a lot of crossover between epidemiology and what we're talking about here. So really what you're doing is you're taking data sets, unstructured data sets from across the media, and this can be written or this can be transcribed from televised material, and you're looking at patterns, clusters, and the behavior of them to determine what now? How is this implemented into, okay, I want to invest in XYZ, or I should be bullish or bearish? Can you give us some ideas? How does that work?
Yeah, sure. So at its core, what we're talking about here is all based on this advertising model. And it's all based on the idea that there is a life cycle to these, and that what Wall Street does is it cycles through these different stories. Different stories have different periods of time where they rise and they fall. But for most, I'll call it kind of sector stories, like, oh, you should be looking at the energy sector. Or, oh, you should run away from the energy sector. You know, typically, these themes or these ideas have a takes about a month for them to build, a month for them to live, and then about a month for them to die. So what we're trying to identify is what are those inflection points on the life cycle of a narrative. And so we think we've gotten pretty good at identifying when one of these narratives is just being born. And so we want to overweight and get ahead of whatever it's talking about, the entity it's talking about. And then we also think we've gotten pretty good at identifying the inflection point of when it is saturating the market. You know, frankly, one of our best indicators of that is when a theme or a narrative has in fact been promoted through social media. By the time it gets into everybody's Twitter feed and stock tweets and Facebook, by that time, when, you know, kind of the local doctor and lawyer are talking about it, we want to be underweight that. It's a behavioral model of how the world works. We can tell you nothing about the fundamentals of anything, right? We can tell literally nothing we can tell you about that. We think we can tell you a lot, again, about the hardwired and socially trained ways we have of behaving to the messages that we think are even more fundamental than fundamentals.
So in a sense, you could say that when a certain story or topic has reached mass penetration across society at that point, I mean, that would be a very good signal that you want to be a contrarian, right? That you've reached an inflection point.
Absolutely. Yep. These are contrarian signals. These are absolutely contrarian signals. It's a momentum idea, right? But it's not price momentum. And it's independent of price momentum. Narrative momentum comes before price momentum. It is a signal of price momentum. And frankly, that is for us, I think, the most exciting part of our most recent research, which is that we think that through our narrative analysis, we can identify when trend following strategies work and when they don't. And if you're familiar with trend following strategies, that's a pretty big question to answer.
And I guess this relates to the latest iteration of what you're rolling out, and that's Narrative Machine 3.0, as you recently wrote. So do you mind telling our listeners a little bit about that and obviously how they can get on board with what you're doing?
Sure. Well, you know, come to epsilontheory.com. You know, it's just Epsilon Theory all over the place. That's the Twitter handle. That's the website. But on the research side of our business, this is our third iteration of, you know, what we call the narrative machine, our effort at trying to model and implement the big narrative machine, which we think is at the core of all social activities, right? But the narrative machine 1.0 was just trying to identify what thinking in terms of structure and not sentiment. Version 2.0 was thinking in terms of archetypes, these scripts that are repeated over and over again. And here in 3.0, we think we've broken it down into the fundamental building blocks of these narrative archetypes. What are the words and the phrases that are used and combined and recombined to create all these different narratives and archetypes? But for us, the way we're describing it is that our first effort was building the microscope where you could actually see, you know, if you put a, be like in 1700, you've got a little drop of dirty water and you put it under this simple microscope and you see, oh my God, there's a whole world of living creatures in there. We can see them for the first time. Version 2.0, looking at archetypes, was building a more powerful microscope, saying, well, you know, each of these little creatures that's swimming around in this drop of water, they all have a nucleus. They all have these different things that are inside the single-celled organism. They all have the same kind of cell wall. That's got to be important. Version 3.0, we think we've gotten inside the nucleus itself to get at the DNA, right? These core building blocks, the most fundamental building blocks of narrative. And that's why we're so excited, right, about what's possible now in terms of really understanding and get a higher magnification resolution of how these narratives impact our behavior and impact the outcome in markets.
All right. Well, perfect. That, and your work is just absolutely fascinating. I love your writings. You are a master of metaphor. I love the metaphors in obviously in writing a lot about metaphors, explaining just your ability to explain things and describe them using such appropriate metaphors is very helpful. So again, if any of our listeners wanted to follow more of your work, the best place to do so would be at epsilontheory.com. Is that correct?
That is it.
Well, Ben, always a pleasure to speak with you. And thank you for sharing the narrative machine, how this works, how we should understand the economy and the markets today. And I hope that you have changed people's perceptions, because I know you've definitely done that for me. And we look forward to speaking on the show again. That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.